did a snort. Make sure we cut that out.
Oh, no, I'm going to amp that up.
Standard issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 161 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan and I am still reeling from the football fact that Italy has a player called Kevin Lasagna.
I think I've missed that. That's brilliant.
Isn't that wonderful?
During the England game, I'm pretty sure that on two separate occasions I heard someone say Matt Bianco and I thought, they can't be on there. What is that about?
There is also, this took me down a little wormhole, but there is also a English Ghanaian professional footballer currently playing for Dover Athletic called Naughty Naughty.
Amazing.
That's terrific.
He's a good... He might be, I don't know.
Is that what they sing?
I don't know, they should. If they're not, they should be singing.
Hey,
that.
Dover Athletic, you can have that for free.
Uh-huh.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and yes, I did put money on Andy Murray winning Wimbledon. I take full responsibility for what happened next.
Oh, poor Andy Murray.
No. I'm Jen Offord, and I went to stay with my friend Catherine at the weekend, and she loves Robin Hood even more than I do, or you do,
what?
Or anyone does. I know, it's impossible. And she was a bit disappointed that I hadn't said, when we talked about it, that I hadn't done the there's always room for one more thing. So, Catherine, if you're listening, which she will be, that's for you. But also, she told me an incredible piece of information, which is that there is apparently some sort of director's cut of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, in which they explore in more detail the backstory, the origin story, if you will, of Mortiana the Witch. And she's Nottingham's mum.
Oh.
Wowzers.
Brand new information.
There's the weekend sorted.
Later on, I chat to Zencho about representations of Malaysia, haunting grannies, and her new book, Blackwater Sister.
I've been on the Zoom with our Yosra Osman, talking about what films you should be taking a look at in the coming months.
In Journey Off the Blocks, I'm talking about everything.
Sports! There's so much sport! I can't move the sport! Just sport everywhere!
There's so much.
There's so much sport that I'm watching sport.
And telling me about sport.
Yeah.
And in Rated or Dated, we wonder just what is the age difference between Lawrence Fishburne and Cuba Gooding Jr. as we watch 1991's Boys in the Hood.
But first, oh God, to be honest with you, I'm going to struggle to get past Hannah's Bush Telegraph opener, if I'm honest. So let's just crack on. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph. Michael Gove's back on the market, women. Just saying.
If anyone is up for someone who can't even clap or drink a glass of water, then now's your time. Oh, Jen's doing the clap, and even just watching Jen do an impression of it makes me feel sick.
You're welcome.
So, did everybody enjoy Independence Day? It certainly didn't have the same frenzied excitement as last year when the country finally said goodbye to restrictions linked to coronavirus. But fear not. We're having a second crack at it with Freedom Day planned this year for July the 19th. What could possibly go wrong?
I don't know.
These things remind me of Drop Dead Gorgeous, where Kirstie Alley comes up with a different thing that's happened that just happens to be the same thing every year. I don't know. Maybe we can talk about that in the run-up to 2022's Latitude Day or 2023's Profligacy Week.
That's the one I'm most excited about.
Strong Britain, every week is Profligacy Week at Standard Issue.
Great nation.
Boris Johnson is expected to announce this afternoon, that's as we record, that he is to end social distancing rules, the work from home order, and the imperative to wear a mask in public, advising that people should again rely on their common sense. Now, I'm not going to suggest that the great British public hasn't got any sense. We're not on Twitter. But I would suggest that in the next week, people are going to be excited that this has ended, happy to be around people again, and regardless of how England perform in the Euros, drunk. So, you know, with the best will in the world, reaction to the announcement has been varied. It appears to defy BMA advice, British Medical Association, that is. It's been criticised by Sage psychologists, worth pointing out that word there, psychologist, Professor Stephen Riker, and comes despite anecdotal evidence that double jabbers are still vulnerable to infection. The Duchess of Cambridge is the most high-profile example, but while we're on this, a big hello and get well soon to our friend Sam, who is also laid low with COVID.
Get well, one for...
The Daily Mail, on the other hand, reported concerns that mask wearing could remain by stealth in pubs and shops and on public transport. And if anyone out there could explain to me how you wear a mask stealthily, I'm all ears.
I've got one laser printed with an exact photocopy of my lower half of my face.
You'll never have to do your tash again, mate.
I know. That's why I had it done. I just happened to have it handy.
So, lads, are you thinking of burning your masks, or are you happy to be ripping them off, or, you know, something more nuanced in between?
Hannah, when are you going to learn that nuance is never going to catch on?
Yeah. I mean, I stress that that guy's a psychologist, not to diminish his, credentials, but to say what he'll be talking about is like the public reaction to masks being off rather than, you know, the scientific evidence at the end of it.
I wanted to ask you about that because I wondered if it was to do with as well, like the psychological impact of the sort of off on, because I feel like the winter lockdown was, I think, you know, we all really, really suffered with the winter lockdown, right? I think not, I don't just mean us three, I mean like anecdotally from the people I've spoken to, you know.
Yeah.
And I felt like I could do this for a bit longer. I don't want to come out of it and go back into it again. I don't want to have to keep like yo-yoing in and out of it again. And I wondered what the psychological impact of that is on people.
I mean, I specifically don't know. He might know, but it is interesting.
We can't. He's a man.
It is.
Shit.
He's a man. I can't. it is interesting. I think some people like are having this reaction, perhaps born through anecdotal sort of evidence. You know, I've seen friends who've been double jabbed catch it, so I don't want to throw caution to the wind. But I think some other people will actually not have that anecdotal information, but will just genuinely be scared still because we were all terrified for a year. And I'm sure that's had some impact on people in the long term. I mean, I don't know. The idea of being on the tube without a mask on freaks me out. So I will continue to wear one until I feel comfortable to take it off.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And the people making those decisions aren't the people taking the tube at like rush hour.
But that said, if it's an inferno this summer down on the Central Line again, maybe your circumstances might actually make me say, I've got to take it off. It's so frigging hot. Masks are an easier sell in winter than they are in summer, I think.
It's tricky because as a glasses wearer, I really, really do not enjoy the mask. I do not. It's, you know, it's a pain in the fucking ass, to be honest. But, and I think this is where it all sort of starts to unravel, doesn't it? Because you're not wearing them to protect yourself. You're wearing them to protect other people. That's what we've been told. So if everyone else isn't wearing one, why the fuck should I? And that's where it all starts to unravel, I think. You know, not to say that I won't, but it's understandable that people are going to feel like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. I think some people are definitely, I mean, we can see them. Mickey's actually putting a mask on mid-recording just
a fancy mask.
Jen, the point is that you are entitled to come to your own decision based on the evidence presented to you, because the law now is that you won't have to wear one. I believe it's your choice.
And I tell you what, letting the people choose, that's always going to go really well, isn't it?
I come back to the fact that the people voted Noel Edmonds out of I'm a Celebrity first, and I just don't think we should be able to make decisions anymore.
I don't know whether to be worried, Jen, that that is your go-to of what the people might have got wrong in a vote.
Obviously, there are other examples, but that's the one that really strikes me.
Well done. Interesting chat.
Let's head over to America. And for more info on what is going on there outside of COVID and the Miami tragedy, please do give our Independence Day chat with the excellent Helen Lewis a listen. In other news, last week was quite the week for the American legal system when it came to protecting women. And by quite the week, I mean it very much wore its don't give a fuck dude badge with your honours. Britney Spears' request to be set free from her father's control, which she deems abusive, and we covered the ins and outs of the singer's conservatorship in last week's Sexism of the Week, was denied by an LA judge. So, as it stands now, Britney is still considered fit enough to work, which, by the by, brings in a lot of cash for her dad, Jamie, but not fit enough to make decisions regarding the IUD she currently has fitted against her will. On the same day Britney was denied her freedom, Bill Cosby walked out of jail, having seen his 2018 conviction for 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault overturned by the Supreme Court due to a legal technicality. That's right, Cosby, who on record admitted that he gave quaaludes to women he intended to have sex with, very much putting that in inverted commas, has walked free after serving just 2 years of a 3 to 10 year sentence. Not because new evidence has come to light or because old evidence has been proven false, but because of that admission he drugged women, which was used in a trial against him after a prosecutor deal pledged it would not be. To be fair, the US legal system is about as good at protecting women as ours is. That is not a compliment. And it is kind of telling that 2 of the 6 male Supreme Court justices have been accused of sexual misconduct. Still, I am pretty sure that had no weight at all in the decision to overturn Cosby's conviction. Why would it? Another way of looking at it is, as @the_law_boy on Twitter wrote, a lot of people are trying to understand why Bill Cosby is being released from prison. As an experienced attorney, I can explain. He is extremely, extremely rich. Because Cosby's release isn't just a huge, fresh devastation to the women he victimised. 60 came forward, but except for Nancy Constand, the statute of limitations for all the accusers with enough evidence to bring a case had passed by the time they went public with the allegations. It isn't just a fresh reminder as to why women aren't reporting sexual assaults. According to the US's Rape, Abuse and Incest National Network, out of 1,000 sexual assaults, 975 perpetrators go free. It is also a signal to other predators, the very few who maybe hadn't got away with it, that they too can get away with it. Cue this from convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein's lawyers. This decision also reaffirms our confidence that the Appellate Division in New York will reach the similarly correct decision in Harvey Weinstein's appeal.
Yeah, I mean, I think Harvey Weinstein's dreaming, because the reason this fell apart was because of something very clear that happened in this case. And I could not agree with @thelawboy harder that if the law is flawed, you know, it does need fixing. But currently, as it stands, that could have happened to other people. But if you can't afford the lawyer that's going to get you out, you're going to remain in prison. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at this as the case of that this is technically, like, technically correct, I don't agree with the result, but as the law stands, that this has been able to happen, only money will save you from that. And that frankly disgusts me as much, you know, as the message it sends out to people like Harvey Weinstein's lawyers.
Christ. You might remember a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about the Paralympics in Jenny Off the Blocks and how the BBC had basically pissed off everyone by referring to the Olympic Games as the main Olympics. I've said Olympics a lot in that sentence. So to clarify, for those who are unaware, the Olympic Games, in which able-bodied athletes compete, is followed by the Paralympic Games, in which Paralympic athletes compete. They're separate events, but obviously very closely related. Although what I did not know until this morning was that the agreement to run the two events in tandem was actually only formalised in 2001. Which
not
is
not long far, ago at all.
No, yeah. That's much more recent than I thought it was. So a bit of good news in this department is very much welcomed, and there is some.
Hooray!
Hooray! And that is that more than 70% of Channel 4's presenting team for this Games will be presenters with disabilities. That team includes a veteran Paralympics presenter and wheelchair basketball player Ade Adepitan and disability advocate Sophie Morgan. Perhaps even better news from a standard issue perspective is the addition of comedian Rosie Jones reporting from Tokyo for The Last Leg Daily Show.
Hooray!
Hooray indeed. The Olympic and Paralympic Games are massive platforms for showcasing women's sport that you wouldn't normally be able to see on terrestrial television. And so, of course, the Paralympics is the same for disability sport. I'll be chatting in next week's Podzine about the impact of the COVID pandemic on disability sports. Spoiler alert, it hasn't been good. Even more welcome is the news that Channel 4 have really upped the ante in terms of coverage too. More 4 will become a dedicated sports channel for the event, with an additional 16 live streams being broadcast from the Channel 4 Paralympics microsite. Additionally, the coverage will be more accessible with live subtitles as well as signing and enhanced audio description and commentary across a range of the broadcasts, because representation matters. Well done, Channel 4.
Indeed. I have a request, though. If you're listening, Channel 4, please, 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 can we have more women on the last leg? It is so cock-heavy. But not even so much the presenters. The guests last time were predominantly male. And this is the best chance most female Paralympians will have to get on the telly, is to be on the last leg. So put some on, please, and thank you.
Yeah, agreed.
Good request.
I mean, I don't want to show off, guys, but I've actually got some more good news. Would you like to hear it?
I think you are showing off, but still, yes.
Friend of the show, June Sarpong, so charming.
So damn charming.
So charming, has launched a new publishing imprint alongside HQ, which is a division of HarperCollins, aimed at promoting the work of debut authors from underrepresented communities. HQ Creative Inclusion Lab, it's a very snappy name, will give a voice to those with disabilities and from black and ethnic minority and working class backgrounds, among others. Sarpong has been a major advocate for diversity and inclusion for a number of years. She wrote a book about it, Diversify, which she has actually spoken to Mick about on this very podcast.
I knew you were there.
And oh, I was there, that's correct. Did I talk? I don't know. Anyway, she is the BBC's Director of Creative Diversity as well. And talking about the launch of HQ Creative Inclusion Lab, she said, "It is such an honour to be able to offer a platform for new voices from diverse backgrounds. There are so many stories that are yet to be told from worlds that have so much rich content to offer a mainstream audience."
That is good news.
More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week. It's that time of the week where we look at sexism and see if there's anything that needs sorting left. 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 Right. Left. Over in the Ukraine, plans by its defence ministry to have female soldiers march in high heels instead of army boots have caused a ruckus.
Oh dear.
A military parade is planned for August 24th to mark 30 years of independence following the collapse of the Soviet Union, and photos of the soldiers rehearsing showed the women soldiers in combat fatigues and black pumps with block heels. Each rehearsal lasts 4 hours, which beats the amount of time I can walk in heels by approximately 4 hours. For the first time, training has taken place in heel shoes, Ivana Medveda, a cadet, was cited as saying by the Defence Ministry. "It is slightly harder than in army boots, but we are trying." And yeah, the quote I'm reading there definitely says trying, not crying. But I imagine it was hard to make out exactly what she was saying through the sound of her feet screaming. More than 31,000 women now serve in the Ukraine's armed forces. And as Deputy Parliamentary Speaker Elena Kondratyuk pointed out, more than 13,500 women have fought in the current conflict pitting Ukraine against Russian-backed separatists in the east. In case for some reason you are wondering, they've very much done that in boots rather than high heels. The Ukrainian Defence Ministry initially defended the shoes, saying that the parade uniform differed from combat dress. No shit, mate. However, Andriy Taran, come on, Jen, am I pronouncing that right?
I'd say Andre, maybe.
Andre, okay.
Andre
Taran, the defence minister, later said he had listened to the soldiers' comments and that changes to the footwear could be introduced before the August the 24th parade.
I just have this image of trying to get over those, you know, those rope things, those nets of ropes that yeah. they have to climb in a pair of high heels, and it's really tickled me.
I mean, Goldie Hawn didn't even wear heels in Private Benjamin.
I'm joined on Zoom by author of the new book, Blackwater Sister, Zen Cho. Hi, Zen.
Hi.
How are you today? You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. I can see you've got your Zoom bookcase behind you. Can't decipher anything on it. It's too far away. But yeah, it's a good full bookcase there.
The lighting's deliberately dim as well. Although it's actually a really respectable bookcase because my husband's a literature professor. So it's kind of half my... I do the low culture in the household. He does the high culture. So it's half kind of my sort of science fiction and fantasy. And it's half his, you know, weighty tomes on Proust and so on.
If your husband's a literature professor, you definitely want to get that, like, your desk a bit closer to it. So we are here today to talk about your book, Blackwater Sister. You've written a few. We'll talk about that a bit in a minute. But could you tell me, first of all, a little bit about Blackwater Sister?
Yeah, so it's a contemporary fantasy set in Malaysia, which is where I'm from, specifically in Penang. And it's about a young woman called Jess. She spent most of her life in America, but she's now returning to Malaysia, which is where her parents are from. And she's just out of university. She doesn't have a job. She's a bit stressed about everything. She's got a girlfriend she really doesn't want her family to know about. And she starts hearing a voice in her head. And it turns out to be the voice of her estranged grandmother who happens to be dead. And so her grandmother has very strong ideas about what she thinks Jess should be doing with her life and just gets drawn into all kinds of adventures featuring ghosts, gods, and grandmas.
Ghosts, gods, and grandmas. How did you get the idea for this? Because obviously you're Malaysian, and some of it is about, you know, the immigrant experience and kind of intergenerational baggage and sort of hangover from that, I guess. And I just wondered, like, how much of it is based on your own experiences? Presumably not the haunting by the dead grandmother, but I don't know, feel free to tell me otherwise.
But you never know. No, I've not had any encounters of a supernatural kind. I guess one jumping off point is my family did, like Jess's family, did actually emigrate to America or attempt an emigration, I guess, when I was young. So I lived in America for a couple of years when I was around 6 and 7 years old. But we decided to come back to Malaysia. And actually, in the first scene of Blackwater Sister, there's a discussion between Jess and her mum, where her mum finds a picture that Jess has drawn, because this is a period of time where her dad's struggling to get a job in America. And he starts flying back and forth between Malaysia because he's got more opportunities in Malaysia. And her mum says, you know, this is unsustainable. And I thought about bringing us all home. And in fact, that's what happened with my family. My dad struggled to get a job in America, but he had these opportunities back home in Malaysia, except that we made a different decision. So Jess's family decided to stay in America and kind of tough it out. And we went back to Malaysia. And actually, I think my family probably did financially a lot better by going back to Malaysia, which I think is kind of interesting because it kind of counters this kind of classic immigrant narrative, I guess, of moving, you know, to the West for a better life.
You know, as you were saying that and reading it in the book, what struck me is that you hear a lot about immigrants going somewhere else. You don't really hear so much about them then going back, choosing to go back to where they're from, because actually the immigrant experience isn't necessarily that great for everyone.
And it's not that uncommon, actually. I know quite a few people, you know, personally people generally. For example, particularly, I think, in arts and entertainment, where it can be really quite difficult. Say if you're an East Asian or Southeast Asian actor, you know, I think in the UK or even the US, opportunities can be relatively limited. But, you know, in the kind of East Asian entertainment industry, there are quite a lot of kind of Asian Americans, for example, who, if they're kind of good enough at the language or can learn it, do a lot better. So Wang Leehom, who's one of the most famous Chinese singers in the world, is Asian American. And he's sort of based in Taiwan, I think.
The book is kind of, I don't know how you would describe it, but I was sort of getting like a kind of folk fantasy sort of almost fusion, because you've got this deity that Armar is worshipping, this the Blackwater Sister. I wondered, I mean, not is Blackwater Sister real, because obviously she's not, but was any of that based on real Malaysian kind of folk stories? And
yeah, so one of the inspirations for the book actually was this book that I read called The Way That Lives in the Heart, which is by an anthropologist based in Canada. But in the 1980s, she went to Penang in Malaysia to do field research. And particularly what she studied was the practice of Chinese popular religion and spirit mediumship. And spirit mediumship is what happens when you sort of invite a god to possess you. And then you can kind of do consultations. You can give advice and you can help people with their problems. Or rather, the god in you does that. And I basically kind of grew up with this religious practice, which is quite sort of syncretic. So I would always describe myself in forms as Buddhist. But in fact, you know, the temples we went to were a mix of kind of Buddhist, Taoist, and kind of general Chinese folk religion. But my parents were very superstitious. So there's a line in the book where it says, you know, just as parents' attitude to religion is that they leave the gods alone in the hope that the gods will do them the same favor. That was pretty much my parents' attitude. So they never really explained anything. We just brought the temples and told, you know, what to do, but not kind of told why we were doing it or anything like that. So when I read this book as an adult, it kind of, what it did was give me kind of an intellectual framework for these beliefs I'd grown up with. And so I just thought it was just really interesting, and I knew there was a novel in it. So that's kind of where that came from. So you're right that Blackwater Sister, for example, is an invented deity, but she's very much inspired by real, I guess, small gods.
The protagonist is Malaysian, and indeed, so are you. I feel certainly in the UK, there aren't that many representations of Malaysian culture in our culture, or not sort of in the mainstream anyway. And I wondered, is that something that you specifically wanted to represent in this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's always interested me, kind of writing about the culture and the society I grew up in. I grew up in Malaysia reading a lot of books because we are an English-speaking family, so I spoke English at home. My parents spoke Hokkien, which is a Chinese dialect, to each other, but the kids spoke English, mainly because I think my parents thought it would kind of help us get ahead. Like, they had both gone to English medium schools, so my mum had been taught by British nuns, actually. So they kind of associated, I guess, the language with kind of education and power and stuff like that. And I grew up reading in English, but really not reading any Malaysian writers. You know, all the books were from Britain and, you know, from UK and the US. And kind of Canada, I guess, Australia, places like that. So for a very long time as a child, I was fairly convinced that you had to be white in order to be in a book, because I didn't really have any contrary evidence. So to me, it does feel important to write stories about the sort of people I knew and know in real life, you know, just because it seems quite odd to me, you know, to have this whole imaginative space that is not occupied by my reality.
Obviously, as I said earlier, you've written quite a few books. Are these same kind of themes represented in those books, or is this sort of the first one that you've dedicated to Malaysian culture?
So this is the first full-length novel that that's set in Malaysia and kind of drawn on the practice, you know, kind of the beliefs of the Chinese community there, you know, to this extent. But my first book actually was a short story collection called Spirits Abroad, which is actually being re-released in August, because previously it was published by a Malaysian publisher, and so not really available outside that country. But now hopefully it'll be available to a wider audience. And that is were short stories very, very much in a similar vein to Blackwater Sister, actually. So kind of the broad theme was kind of like young woman encounter supernatural creature. And it drew a lot on kind of Malaysian folklore. So Blackwater Sister very much focuses on kind of specifically Chinese religious belief as it's kind of manifests in Malaysia. But Spirits Abroad draws on some of the more different local hantu, which are kind of like ghosts or demons. And then my first two novels, Sorcerers to the Crown and True Queen, are historical fantasies, and they're set in England, and they're kind of like Jane Austen with dragons and people of color is what kind of how I describe them. But, you know, even they have a prominent theme. So the second book is about a young woman from the Malayan archipelago, and the first one features characters from Malaya as well. So it's always been kind of an ongoing theme with me, I think.
The protagonist is female, and she is, as you say, she's sort of fresh out of college, and she's a bit all over the shop. She's a bit lost, isn't she? But I was kind of interested in the fact that you know, there's two female protagonists, really. You've got Jess, and then you've got Amar, who's her grandma, who's kind of like possessing her, basically. And she's very funny, Amar. She's very, like, you know, she's a very dry and witty and quite lovable battle axe, really. Is she based on anyone particular?
She's not based on any specific person, but elements of her, I guess, are drawn from people I know. So I have a lot of very kind of strong-minded kind of aunties in my life, you know, both people who are related to me and aren't. And I guess that, you know, they tend to be very direct in kind of getting what they want, and fairly kind of interfering, and have very strong ideas about what you should be doing, but don't want to be told what they should be doing. And so I guess that was a big inspiration for me. Amma is a lot nastier than either of my grandmothers, but there is inspiration for her life from my grandmother's life. So like my grandmother, she's illiterate, you know, never went to school. She married young to a man who was a lot older than her. So that was my maternal grandmother. That's what happened to her. And then she's a rubber tapper because her husband isn't a great kind of provider. And so she has to kind of find a way of making a living, which, you know, if you're not, you're an uneducated woman, it's probably quite difficult. And so my paternal grandmother was a rubber tapper. So kind of elements of their lives went into her. But I would say her personality is kind of made up, not from scratch, but invented.
Did you want to juxtapose those kind of generational differences to show how lost Jess was in comparison to this quite feisty old lady?
Yeah, well, that wasn't so much what I was looking to highlight, although it is, you know, it was kind of inevitable because I think, you know, when you're a lot older, like Ama is, so she's dead, but she died in her 70s or 80s. Like, obviously she would have come to, you know, some sort of sense of who she was, whereas Jess is at the very beginning and she's just working out who she is. And also because of her family and the fact that, you know, she doesn't think her family would accept her being gay, she's had to suppress quite a big side of herself. And so, I you know, that obviously affects her development. But I think what I was kind of interested in, I'm not saying I thought about this consciously, but kind of looking at the book now that it's been written, I can see it's a major theme, is kind of, you know, who you are is shaped by when you are and where you are. And I think Jess and Ama and actually the Blackwater sister as well, each kind of exemplify that. So it's said expressly that Jess looks a lot like her grandmother, and her grandmother kind of points out that they have similarities. For example, she tells Jess, you're angry like me. But actually, they are very different in the sense that Jess has a lot more privilege because, you know, she was born to parents who thought it was important that she be educated, that she be safe, that she not have to marry someone she doesn't want to marry, that she is happy. You know, that those are all priorities to her parents in a way that for Ama, probably they weren't, you know, almost certainly they weren't priorities to her parents. And so Ama is really, I think why people, readers like her, is that she's not a very nice person, let's be honest. Yeah. But she, you know, in the course of the book, you work out that that's how she's had to be to survive, yeah, you know, in a fairly harsh society. And I think what you find as the book goes on is that although Jess seems pretty lost and powerless at the beginning, she has kind of resources, she has abilities that neither Ama nor the Blackwater sister have because she's been kind of looked after all her life. And she's, you know, she's got all these kind of privileges. She's got a kind of very high prestige accent. She's got a high prestige education. And she kind of matters, you know, in a way that perhaps Ama didn't.
I was just thinking, as you were saying that the further into a woman's life she gets, I think almost universally, the less she seems to matter to the world. So I just wanted to ask you, because the book is, and you tend to write sort of fantasy books, right? How did you get into that? Was that just your favourite genre of what you like to read?
I kind of say with Blackwater Sister, this applies to Spirits Abroad, which was my first book, which I mentioned, which is also being re-released in August, that they kind of get sold as fantasy, but they're not necessarily fantasy. It depends on how you read it. Yeah. So Blackwater Sister, for example, deals with, as I said, basically a living faith tradition of spirit mediumship and so on. Blackwater Sister herself isn't a real deity, but she's kind of inspired by real gods. And, you know, some of the gods mentioned in the book are real gods. And by real gods, I mean that you could go to a temple, you know, dedicated to them in Malaysia and probably speak to a spirit medium possessed by one. So in that sense, although obviously the practices are heightened, you know, dramatized for the purpose of the book, in a way, it's not really fantasy. It's just kind of, it's drawing on kind of real life belief. And with Spirits Abroad, because I was talking about these kind of local supernatural beliefs, and I would say like a belief in the supernatural is probably more widespread in Malaysia than it is in the UK. I would say most of my friends believe in the supernatural, most of my Malaysian friends, I should say, you know, that includes people who are kind of educated and so on. And so, like I said, they get sold as fantasy because that's kind of how they get read in the Western market, but they're not necessarily fantasy. Certainly, Sorcerer to the Crown and True Queen are straight up fantasy, dragons and so on. I always say about your subject that your subject chooses you. You don't necessarily choose your subject as a creator. But I would say why I'm drawn to fantasy is kind of a mix of a few different things. Like, I just enjoy some of the tropes of the genre, like dragons. Part of it as well is just maybe growing up in a society where the line between what's real and not real was maybe a bit more blurred than it is in kind of most Western societies.
Obviously, you've got another book, as you said before, is being sort of republished in August, and Blackwater Sister is available now. What else have you been up to? What else have you got coming up?
Well, I haven't really got anything else coming up. I think two books in a year is quite respectable.
Absolutely, yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
I've got a day job and a small child as well, so keeping it all going is a kind of a challenge. What I'm actually just doing is just having a bit of fun at the moment, so I'm just focusing on kind of shorter fiction, because writing a novel is such a slog. You know, it's really rewarding once it's done, but it takes such a long time.
Zen, are you on any kind of social media where we can sort of follow what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as Zenaldehyde, because some jerk took Zen Cho. But aldehyde is A-L-D-E-H-Y-D-E, and it's because it's carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So anyway, your little chemistry joke for the day.
Who doesn't want a chemistry joke for the day? Zen, thank you so much for chatting to me, and good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I am joined on the phone by Yosra Osman, our film expert. Yosra, hello.
Thanks for having me back. I wasn't sure you were going to after Clueless.
You are always welcome here. So I went to the cinema the other day, and the experience of being in the cinema made me think that we should really talk about what is on at the cinema, because A, there weren't that many people there, and B, I watched In the Heights, and I think In the Heights is one of those films that demands to be seen on the big screen. So I think we should try and encourage people. But before we do that, I just wanted to ask you what your recent trips to the cinema have been like, what the experience has been like for you.
Really good. I've had a really nice time going back to cinema. I've missed it. And the first film I saw back at the cinema was A Quiet Place Part 2, which I actually think was a really fun film to go and experience in a cinema with the few other people that were there.
Yeah.
Because the first film, I remember watching on my laptop and thinking it wasn't that scary. The second film, watching it in a cinema with the proper sound that you're meant to hear in a cinema experience, I was jumping out my seat the whole time. I was laughing at other people jumping out their seats at bits. It was just the ideal experience. So that was a great one. As you said, In the Heights is a brilliant, still in cinemas now, really fun musical. If you like your musicals, if you like Lin-Manuel Miranda. I have also seen something slightly different, The Father, which is what Anthony Hopkins recently won his Oscar for. And I've also seen Supernova with Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci. Slightly different to A Quiet Place 2 and In the Heights, but again, really nice experience to see on the big screen.
Okay, let's start with In the Heights then, because God knows we love Lin-Manuel Miranda. His first musical, obviously, now made into a film. Also, sort of technically, the first of his musicals to be made into a film, because the Hamilton film, for people that haven't seen it, is a recording of the live stage show on Broadway. I was ever so excited about going to see this. I took my nephew, who is also a huge Hamilton fan, and I absolutely loved it. And I think one of the things that appealed so much and was so glorious to see was people outside in large groups, just living. People just actually living. I found it incredible. 96,000 for anybody who knows In the Heights or who doesn't, watch out for it, because that was absolutely mind-blowingly good.
Yeah.
Starting off with the little animations and leading up to that huge spectacular in the pole. I mean, it was just incredible.
Yeah. It's really good. And the one thing I will say, if you are a Lin-Manuel Miranda fan and you like Hamilton, you will probably like this, but just don't expect it to be Hamilton. It's something else within its own right.
Could you give us a little plot summary for people who might not know?
Sure. So the heights referenced in the title are Washington Heights in New York. Anthony Ramos plays Usnavi, and he owns a small but likeable bodega. And it's basically about him sort of imagining like a better life for himself. But there's a lot that comes into that as well. It's really about a community, a very tight-knit community, and their own dreams and lives and how that all comes together. And I think that's what I really liked about it, as well as just the spectacle of a musical, which I'm always going to appreciate. Mm. It's got community spirit. It's about identity. It's got really fun songs. Go and see it if you're a musical fan.
The sort of sheer joy of it can be summed up but for the fact that Jimmy Smith is in this. And people will say, is that the same Jimmy Smith from L.A. Law? And yes, I can't believe that he still looks so young, but cannot dance. And yet is there, giving it his all. And it's just so joyful.
It's brilliant. You don't like, it's just so fun just seeing that. And people, I think it must be even better, as you said, after lockdown, to see such a fun community just giving it everything. Just brilliant. Really, really good fun and great music.
So, yeah, if it's still on near where you are, we can't predict what's showing what, unfortunately, and where. So if you can get to go and see In the Heights, I would say see that on the big screen, if at all possible. What do you want to go to next? Let's talk about Father.
Yes. Okay, so The Father is Anthony Hopkins, Olivia Colman, Mark Gatiss, as well as many others. And it's one of those films that when I saw it, I didn't really know what to expect. No, I didn't bother looking at what the plot was even about. But to give you a little bit of a summary, it's directed by Florian Zeller. And Anthony Hopkins stars as Anthony. The character's name is Anthony. So Anthony Hopkins stars as a man who is suffering from dementia. And as his circumstances are changing, you sort of see him try... His daughter, played by Olivia Colman, is trying to help with that. He doesn't want any help. He doesn't want to be moved to a home. He likes his flat. He's very comfortable in that. But what I would say I really liked about the film was that it was all from Anthony's perspective. So it really makes you think about what he's actually going through in a different way to other films that treat the theme of dementia. And I think Anthony Hopkins in it is absolutely incredible. Brilliant, brilliant performance, totally believable, makes you really feel for him, but also challenge the perceptions that you're seeing throughout. So that is one that I would also recommend. It was probably one of the best films I've seen this year.
Wow.
Challenging. And, you know, you may have a tear at some point, but just at least see it for Anthony Hopkins' performance.
Let's stick with dementia. And it's not often I say that on this podcast, but yeah, let's look at Supernova, yes. Debut film written and directed by Harry McQueen and starring Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth, almost exclusively, really. There are some other characters in it, but not for long, as Tusker and Sam, a couple of 20 years standing. Tusker, which is Stanley Tucci, has been recently diagnosed with early onset dementia, and they are on a road trip up to the Lake District, where Sam, who is Colin Firth's character, will be playing his first piano recital for some time. It has had incredible reviews, particularly for their performances. I'm interested in what you've got to say next, Joshua, because I have quite strong opinions on this. One, I think it's good. But secondly, I've got some real issues with the way that it delivers the story that it's delivering. And it's going to be quite complicated because it becomes clear on the journey where maybe this journey is going that you didn't think it was going. So I don't want it to be a spoiler, although I will say I thought it was quite obvious where it was going right from the start. The Lake District looks phenomenal. Again, that sort of post-lockdown, just, oh my God, let me just drive up there now. It looks incredible. Really, really solid performances, but I felt it had a kind of superficial sheen, or try to deal with a physical problem on a philosophical level. And I don't think that's always fair to the subject matter. If that's the only way I could say that without being too spoilery. Yosra?
I'm a bit mixed on Supernova for many of the reasons that you've just outlined, actually. It is moving, and I really liked Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth. They're very solid performances. Again, Lake District, all I kept thinking was, God, the Lake District looks gorgeous. I've just got to wait to go somewhere. That would be really, really nice. I could feel it, but sometimes I didn't fully believe in the sentimentality of it. And I have to give Tucci and Firth quite a lot of praise, because if it was other people, perhaps they wouldn't be able to carry the film in the way they did. Mm. And actually, they are so good in their roles that you kind of just sit back and take the ride, literally, with them in their camper van. That's it.
I think it tries to salvage a happy ending from a sad ending, and yet I think realism tells me that ending is sad, however it plays out, if any of that makes sense.
I know what you mean. Yes, it went for the sentimental approach rather than an approach that could be sentimental but have some substance behind it that made it more credible.
Yeah.
And if you have a film which throughout has that sense of tone to it, where actually you are invested in the credibility of it. I just don't think you can end a film like that. Maybe another genre you can, but yeah, not a film that builds it up in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, we got there in the end. We've managed to say what we wanted to say. You're right. I know there's a couple of things on your list that you really want to say coming up. So can you tell us what those are?
Yes. Two films this week that I'm really actually quite excited to see. The first one, I'm not sure if you've heard of it, Hannah, it's called Another Round. Danish film. It did quite well in the awards circuit and it stars Mads Mikkelsen. And the premise of the film is probably what got me quite intrigued by it. It's about a group of teachers who just decide that they're going to drink every day and see what the effects of alcohol are on their social, their professional lives, and wow, just see what happens. I've had very good recommendations from some of my friends who have seen it earlier before the awards circuit started, and I've heard it is a really good film. So I would recommend that. That is showing this week.
Given my obsession with alcohol in society, I can't believe that's passed me by. I'm definitely going to go and see that.
Yeah, that would be a good one. And I love Mads Mikkelsen.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. And the other one is Black Widow, of course. The yes, Black Widow origin story, which long awaited, I think it was meant to come out this time last year, but obviously COVID happened, so it didn't. It's directed by Kate Shortland. It's got Scarlett Johansson, Florence Pugh, who apparently really stands out in this film, David Harbour, just a really good cast. And it is, of course, the origin story of Black Widow. So I'm not sure if you're a Marvel fan.
I do know who Black Widow is. To be honest, I think it's virtually impossible to be on Twitter and not know who she is, even if you're not a Marvel fan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think why I'm interested in watching it, as the origin story of Black Widow, it's about Natasha Romanoff, who is played by Scarlett Johansson. And spoiler alert, if you have not seen Avengers Endgame, just close your ears for a minute. She sadly passed away in Endgame. This takes place obviously before that, and it's about her history as a spy and the relationship she had as a spy before she got involved with the Avengers. So one of my big lockdown activities was I watched all the Marvel films, because I'd only seen a few of them before, and now having seen all of them, I'm a massive convert. Not that I hated Marvel before, but wasn't really that bothered by it, and now I'm totally into it, because any Marvel film I've watched, it just does exactly what it says on the tin, right? It's a really good action adventure. Don't take it too seriously and you will have a great time. So that one I'm really looking forward to. I'm sure lots of people will be going to see that. I think I'm actually going to go and see that one in IMAX if I can, because I want to just get the full whole theatrical experience if I'm going to go and see something in the cinema.
Can I ask you, Yosra, since you are now our appointed Marvel expert?
Oh, no. Okay.
Where is the film, the one Marvel film that I really, really want to see? Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Where is it? Do you know? Is it on the horizon?
It's on the horizon. They've got to get through their backlog that they meant to release in
I don't really care about those ones. I like the Thor ones and I like the Guardians of the Galaxy ones.
Oh, Thor Ragnarok is one of my absolute favourites of all the Marvel films.
Thor Ragnarok, you were the very first person to say to me, just ignore what you think about Marvel films and go and see it. And increasingly it is the film that most, when I hear it mentioned, if someone's talking about it, you see somebody, maybe not even part of that conversation, there is prick up and they go, "Who's talking about Thor Ragnarok?" I was really surprised how much I loved it.
It was great fun. And if you like Marvel, by the way, you're going to be absolutely spoilt for choice over the next few months, because not only have we got Black Widow, we've then got Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings in September, and then we've got The Eternals in November, and then we've got Spider-Man Far From Home in December. So loads of Marvel films coming our way.
Well, I mean, that's good for fans, but maybe good for people. If you want to take your kids, maybe. Whenever we do Rated or Dated, there's basically a list of films that I saw at the cinema that my mum had just taken me there when I was a kid in order to sleep. She just used to put, like, just say, "We're watching this film," and then she would just go to sleep for about 2 hours and wake up at the end of it.
My mum did that. Worst one, I think, was Hey Arnold, which she thought we'd enjoy. Hey Arnold, the movie. Enjoyed it, but she still got her sleep.
I have another question for you, Yosra, which is quite disappointed by the complete lack of trailers that there were when I went to the cinema. Not very many at all, discounting the Dogtania one, which was just horrifying. There was mostly stuff that's quite a way off. Bond, Dear Evan Hansen, which I think is October, and another big stage musical coming to the big screen, and the one that I really wanted to talk to you about, which apparently isn't out until Christmas, but the trailer is available, is West Side Story, the remake by Steven Spielberg. How do you feel about the remake in general? Because I know it's one of your favourite films. And then how do you feel about the trailer that you've seen?
I'm not going to stick my nose up at it. I don't know why they're remaking it. I'm sure there's a really good reason. But the thing that did change how I felt about it was I actually quite enjoyed the trailer when I saw it, because it looks like it's going to be quite a nice touch to the original film. If they were to remake West Side Story and just glamorize it, over Hollywoodize it, if they were going to try and change it from the essence of what West Side Story is, and I'm saying this as a huge West Side Story fan, I would feel a bit differently. But just seeing the 2-minute trailer that I saw in a cinema, it just had a really nice energy about it. The dance scenes, I even recognised the moves exactly from the original West Side Story. You know, Rita Moreno's in it again. Mm-hmm. She's decided to be in it, so it can't be that bad. so I thought, you know, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. I'm excited to see it. I mean, we talked about it recently, where we talked about, you know, the fact that West Side Story is one of my favourite films, but it does have its problems. And it's going to be quite interesting to see how the Spielberg one may do some of that differently. I don't know, but what I really got from watching it on that trailer was just thinking that actually this could be a really nice homage to the original film. I hope. Maybe I'm getting my hopes up. I don't know what you thought about it.
Generally not a huge fan of musicals, oddly. I'm just a fan of about 5 specific musicals, but I'm a really big fan of those. So I haven't felt a level of closeness to it where I felt it was sacrilege for someone to try and make it again. But equally, I'm not in a rush to see it. But that said, seeing the trailer on a big screen, it did feel, you know, I mean, it's coming out in December, so this won't be the thing. But it did seem like the sort of thing that were it coming out in the summer and were it a hot day and I was stuck in my hot house, I would think, oh, I might go and see West Side Story in an air-conditioned cinema and have quite a happy afternoon.
It's one of those films I feel like it could be an event. You know, you take your friends and you have a really good time. And I love seeing films where, you know, I'll try not to do this in the middle of cinema and annoy everyone, but I can sing along to the songs. I know them. It might just be a really comforting watch.
Yeah.
I hope so. I don't like to be sniffy about remakes for things generally. So I'm going to give it a go.
Yosua, is there anything else that you'd like to mention before we both get back to our real lives?
We were talking about trailers, and in the middle of, I think, In the Heights and West Side Story, I saw the trailer for Stillwater, Tom McCarthy film with Matt Damon, it's coming out towards the end of this month. And Matt Damon plays a father whose daughter is in prison for, I think, murdering her flatmate or something. I think it's loosely based on Meredith Kitcher and Amanda Knox. So when I first was watching it, I thought, oh gosh, this could be really dark. But it's his own tale. He goes to Marseille to find out what's happened and try and exonerate his daughter. So that one could be interesting.
I love, love, love Tom McCarthy. My favourite film is a Tom McCarthy, The Station Agent.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, and he wrote the best Pixar film as well, which is Up.
Have I showed you my diamond picture that I finished of Up?
No, but we'll have to...
irrelevant.
That seems to me to be the perfect place to stop on. Let's go and look at that diamond picture. Thank you for being here, Yosra.
Thanks.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny off the blocks, that time of the week when we... Oh, sport! There's so much, so very much. So, let's start with, how does it feel to be on top of the world? And by world, I mean Euros, and by on top of, I mean, oh, sport! Yes, we did it. We're through. Through to the semi-finals of the Euros, and by we, I mean England. And you'd forgotten about that song too, hadn't you? actually re-listened to it as I was writing this. The Spice Girls input is mercifully brief, and I have to say, I didn't give it nearly the credit it deserved at the time. For the uninitiated, it was England's 1998 World Cup offering, with a fantastically low-budget video, a Gareth Southgate penalty lol, and a reminder that Dave Seaman has always looked about 45 years old. I can't lie, Dave, that tash, it was quite ageing on a 25-year-old. Let's talk Dave Seaman, or rather, let's talk Gareth Southgate trying not to cry after England beat Germany last week for the first time in the knockout stages of a tournament in 55 years. I have found it quite hard to get excited about this tournament at times, I can't lie. It's been a weird season and I am very, very tired. But I fucking love the Gareth Southgate redemption arc. It's excellent. And while I have genuinely questioned in the last few weeks whether England fans really deserve nice things, I'm back in full Southgate obsession mode and he deserves all of it. Oh God! And to add to that, so does Raheem Sterling, and I enjoyed watching him cuddling one of his 25 kids after the match. Listener, he has two. The other 23 are figments of your Uncle Barry's racist imagination. What a delight to see him doing so well in the face of so much just abuse from the press, from fans, from everyone really. So, you know, massive props to Sterling. Is it coming home? Stop it. If you're listening to this after Wednesday, you know better than past me, recording this on Tuesday morning, but I can handle losing to Denmark. They may not be, you know, what you would necessarily call a great footballing nation, but I love Kasper Schmeichel, who's, of course, the goalkeeper for Leicester City. And, you know, they had a bit of a shit start, didn't they? So if I could forgive anyone in the tournament for knocking us out, I think it would have to be Denmark. Right, tennis. Andy Murray is out, as you've heard in the intro. So too is fellow Brit and wild card Emma Raducanu, who retired during her fourth round match against Australia's Ayla Tomjanovic in the second set on Monday night. Shortly before she retired, she was clutching her tummy a bit and she was looking as if she was breathing quite heavily. Martina Navratilova on the BBC punditry team speculated perhaps nerves had gotten the better of her. It was later confirmed that she was having breathing difficulties. So I really hope that's just a sort of short-term thing and that she feels better soon. Because what I can say is that I thought she was a real joy to watch. She was really fast, her movement was really good. I think, fingers crossed, we'll be seeing a lot more of her in the future. And Tomjanovic will now face her compatriot Ash Barty in the quarterfinals. Okay, let's get on to the main business of the day and the huge news that US sprinter 21-year-old Sha'Carri Richardson will not be competing at the Olympics after being handed a one-month ban, having tested positive for marijuana use. That makes me feel a bit like my mum saying that, marijuana. Anyway, Richardson was a huge hope for the US track and field team. Earlier this year, she ran the sixth fastest 100-metre time in history when she won at a test event last month, the event at which she tested positive. The Texan said that her biological mother had recently died and that she'd been using the drug as a coping mechanism. So look, we could debate this for hours, days even, whether or not cannabis should be considered performance enhancing, what drugs are banned and why, and whether or not they've got it right, the moral rights and wrongs of drugs use, the mitigating circumstances, etc., etc. We really could spend days talking about this. If you want my opinion, and possibly you do if you're listening to this, the fact of the matter is, the rules are the rules are the rules. You spend years as an elite athlete training for this event. Your whole training cycle is geared around it. You're probably being tested more than ever in the run-up to it. It is insane to me to think that you would at this point break the rules and somehow get around it. Her personal circumstances are obviously very sad, but you cannot take those into account just because she's really fast. Otherwise, you're basically in the fucking Wild West. You'd literally spend your entire careers firefighting in the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So to quote Ted Hastings, I am only interested in the letter of the law here. And you sort of have to be if you want the outcome to be fair. Anyway, moving on. Oh, sport! There's more! It was reported last week that competitors would not be allowed to wear a swimming cap designed for afro hair at international competitions, including the Tokyo Olympics. The reason for this was because, according to the world governing body FINA, the hats did not allow for the natural form of the head. Well, there's a couple of obvious problems with that statement. One, it depends on whose head you're talking about and whether or not it happens to have afro hair on it. And two, who fucking cares? You know, sometimes... I genuinely wonder if I've been in a coma for the last 20 months and all of this has been like a really, really elaborate dream. Getting pregnant, lockdown, foraging the empty aisles of Sainos for toilet paper, some of the mad shit the women in my local mum WhatsApp group said about having their placentas made into tablets for nutritional purposes. Then I hear stories like this, and I know I fundamentally lack the imagination to make up such fucking stupid things. A matter of days and a Twitter storm later, and Fina announced it was reviewing the situation. Good. Good! And if you're wondering, what the Jeff is your problem, you absolute snowflake, let us consider the fact that in Britain, 29.3% of white children participate in swimming compared to 21.9% of Asian children and 21% of black children. Let us also consider the fact that Alice Dearing is, in 2021, the first ever black woman to be selected to compete for Team GB at an Olympic Games. And ask yourself again, if this matters, because let's face it, it is mostly going to be black women who are impacted by this. And why? For what? You know, I'm sure you can remember a time at school where you didn't want to go swimming anymore because you didn't want to get your hair wet, right? Because having long hair, it's a ball ache having to look after it, it's a ball ache having to wash it, it's a ball ache having to dry it or walk around with wet hair for the next couple of hours. It is important, it does matter, and these are, you know, it might seem silly, but these are barriers to participation. So if it does seem like a little thing, perhaps that's because we haven't had to experience it ourselves. And it does apparently seem to be always people who aren't impacted by shit like this who are making the decision. So I have to say, governing bodies, do better. It's bullshit. And on that bombshell, that is all for me this week. I've probably missed 9,000 other things, but I will be back next week with more women's sport. And hopefully, oh my God, hopefully, some genuine football cheer. I've jinxed it now.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Jen, what film did we watch this week that made me seriously consider changing my name to Furious Styles?
It's such a good name. This week, we watched 1991's Boys in the Hood, a coming-of-age drama of sorts written by John Singleton and also his directorial debut. You may also know Singleton as the writer and director of cinematic great Shaft and Too Fast, Too Furious, but it's fair to say this particular film made something of a splash, earning him the first ever nomination of an African-American in the Academy Awards Best Director category.
Wow.
And also the youngest person ever to have received the nod. I was being a little bit facetious there with that potted filmography. Singleton has made some incredible stuff and was also the co-creator of the hugely successful series Snowfall, which sort of focuses on similar themes to this film. Back to Boys in the Hood. The film centres on a young man called Trey, played by Cuba Gooding Jr., a boy, as the film opens, who is sent to live with his implausibly young dad, Furious, played by Lawrence Fishburne, living in Crenshaw, which is Los Angeles. So he's sort of sent to live with his dad by Mum Reva, played by Angela Bassett. And the two of them obviously also star together in another pretty famous 90s film, What's Love Got to Do With It, uh-huh. For anyone who didn't get that. After too many scraps at school, the idea is that Furious, a principled man, not actually that furious, I thought, but we'll come back to that.
Impassioned Styles. It's not got the exactly. same ring to it, has it?
Exactly.
Ernest. That actually works as a name.
I like that.
The idea is that he will instill some values in his son, lest he fall victim to the same pitfalls surrounding him and the other young black men in his community. And for those who don't know, Inglewood and Crenshaw were both known and, although massively gentrified now, still, to a certain extent, are known as areas of extreme deprivation and largely inhabited by black communities. Trey quickly befriends Doughboy and half-brother Ricky, a good kid with a sort of promising career in the NFL just within touching distance, and their friend Chris. Doughboy is played as an adult by Ice Cube, then fresh from hip-hop group NWA, who largely rapped about similar themes, and in fact the title of this film is inspired by an NWA song. The kids go about their business, they get into scrapes, but Doughboy winds up in trouble with the law at a ridiculously young age, an incident that will change the course of all of their lives as he struggles to stay out of trouble. And the boys survive the daily trauma of growing up in their community against the pressures of police interference, poverty, drugs and warring gangs. There were a few films exploring these kind of themes around this time. Menace to Society, South Central. I don't know if either of you ever saw those, but this is
Menace
sort of
to Society.
Yeah, I think this one is regarded to be sort of one of the better kind of iterations of that sort of genre. It has an approval rate of 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. And this is actually, it's really different to what I remember. I first watched this one and the others like it, which I just spoke about, as a sort of teenager. I think I was probably about 12 when I watched this, which is way too young to have watched this film. But when I'm Catholic,
it must have been profligate week.
Profligacy week.
But so I don't know. I think I watched most of them around that time because my brother was a massive hip hop fan. So he was just watching this stuff because he was a hip hop fan, I think, because Ice Cube was in it, basically. And in my memory, they sort of merge into one, and possibly because of the terrible parody version, Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood. I think my recollection of it was that it was sort of a bit of a silly teen film, but I've done it an enormous injustice. An enormous injustice in my memory, because it's actually a very unflinching and devastating look at the relentless and inevitable cycles of violence that kids in these areas have been trapped in. And the idea that a 24-year-old wrote this is just a bit mind-blowing to me, to be honest. So, Hannah, I know that you'd watched this quite recently because we talked about it off air last week. Mick, had you seen it before?
I had seen it before, but not for a long time.
I had seen it several times contemporaneously when it came out.
Mm.
And yeah, it was really good. And then last year in lockdown, because like the conversation has been about race a lot everywhere, and there's been a kind of, for good or for bad, a look back at earlier iterations of the civil rights movement and to like reassess it. And, you know, like people saying things about Martin Luther King being wrong or Malcolm X being wrong. And I thought about this film and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting because Furious, I was kind of curious to know where Furious, who was considered like the moral centre of this film, where his views fell on the scale. Because this is 1991, so this is pre the Rodney King riots that this was made. So I rewatched it then because two of the points that really raised in this, that he raised in it, are now actually right-wing talking points, which is black-on-black crime and also the role of fatherhood in rebuilding communities. That's why I ended up rewatching it. But yes, I did then watch it this week again.
I've got to say, I really fucking hate the phrase black-on-black crime because we do not refer to white-on-white crime.
No, I know, no. Absolutely. But that is, like I say, the right-wing talking point version of what this film is talking about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the main point of it, isn't it? It opens with, like, an awful statistic and it says that the majority of the crimes, what is it, 1 in 21 at the time that this was made, young black men will be murdered, basically, and a staggeringly high proportion of those are carried out by other young black men. But it reminded me of the chat that I had with the guy from the Fight for Peace Academy a couple of years ago for International Men's Day and the stuff that he told me about the reason for violence. And I actually found it affected me a lot more, obviously because I'd completely remembered it like completely wrongly, but also because I was a kid, so I didn't really understand it. And I think I don't know, I sort of feel like maybe young people watching it, really young people watching it at the time, maybe just kind of viewed it in a sort of, like, kind of hip-hop, I can't really explain it, but, like, I don't know, like, I don't think it would necessarily, well, it wouldn't have occurred to me because I was, like, 12, but it wouldn't have occurred to me that this is, like, real stuff.
Oh, see, I think this is just, like, a really angry howl. It's just, like, literally just, like, a what the fuck that this film is, like, literally shouting.
Yeah. All I mean is that I was too young to kind of really understand. And now, watching it, you're like, because you know that it's real, and you know that it happens, and you know that it's happening all the time here, in a slightly different way, admittedly, but the same shit is going on.
Only because we don't have guns.
Yeah, but we're doing it, you know, kids are doing it with knives. Yeah, yeah. You know, so it's... But yeah, absolutely. As you say, it's the same with the police, isn't it? There's no doubt in my mind that if we had guns, there'd be a lot more of it going on, or it's all a lot worse. But yeah, I found it really, really affecting this time round. What did you think?
It's an excellent film. I'm going to start with that. That is my takeaway point. It's an excellent film. I think as Hannah said, it's just this howl. And it's staggering that 30 years on, that howl is still very, very relevant. I've got to hold my hands up and say, I feel particularly unqualified to talk about this in massive detail, to be honest. Not least because I'm white, but also because I have no idea how old Cuba Gooding Jr. was supposed to be. 15, 34, no fucking idea. And also because it was also horribly, depressingly, heartbreakingly inevitable.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
You start watching it and you're just like, well, this isn't going to have a happy ending. Did that as a little joke there, but I did find the age really hard to gauge. We're never quite told how old Ty is. I think he's like 10, 11 when he goes to live with Furious Styles.
And well, they're taking their SATs at the end,
so
aren't they?
So 17 I guess he's or about 18. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he can look 17 or 18 and he can look 40. And Ice Cube's exactly the same. And I imagine living in what's like fundamentally a war zone will age a kid. But yeah.
But this is interesting with this because they're actually, of all the things we've watched where people were playing teenagers, these guys are actually roughly the closest in age. Like Cuba Gooding Jr., Regina King and Ice Cube are all 20, 21, like mm-hmm. not crazy older than the people that they're playing.
This is why I could never work in a bar anymore, Hannah. I just don't know how old people are.
But Lawrence Fishburne is only 6 years older than Cuba Gooding Jr.
I actually did Google it, and he is like 35 or something when he made it. So he's actually midway in age between the two ages that he's playing and the ages that he's playing.
Because he was a dad at 17, wasn't he?
I think one of the things about how brutal and normalised this is, there's two things about it, and one will get us into a much bigger topic. So I say that after. But the first is the way that when you see grown-up Chris for the first time, you see him for about 5 minutes before it becomes clear that he's in a wheelchair. And it's never really mentioned why he's in a wheelchair. We know that he was shot, but there's no sort of backstory that goes with it. There's no explanation of it. And so it kind of like just makes it feel really normal, like that this just is a thing that people are talking about and it's never really explained. And the second thing is the scene that really is just so fucking just shocking outside of the violence in it is when the young Doughboy and the young Mike are having a conversation about the little girl that lives over the road. And it is so fucking horrifying how sexualized the conversation they are having and how sexism is just permeates this community for whatever reason. And again, I don't want to get too into stuff because I am obviously white, but there is how sort of rap culture and all of that and gang culture is so rampantly misogynist. And I find it like the most depressing thing when they're in the queue for the barbecue, the boys are basically presented with two options, which is one, call the girls bitches and push in front of them, or second, treat them like they're princesses and let them go first. And you're like, where's the real option? They just treat them like they're normal people, like you would anybody else.
Yeah, the language around women in this film is horrific.
Yeah, it's not nice.
Yeah, it's so graphic. And, you know, when one of the girlfriends does say, why you always got to call me like a hoe or a bitch? And he's like, because that's what you are. And that is the discussion around it. That is it. And again, I'm going to stay in my lane. But it's quite key in that rap culture, isn't it? And it's not that's not gone away either.
No.
Another thing that it raises that I would have had absolutely no awareness of at the time of watching it previously is the AIDS pandemic. Mm. Which is interesting because this is 1991 and obviously Ice Cube's former bandmate, Eazy-E, died of AIDS or pneumonia, you know, related to complications because of AIDS in 1995. So that's obviously something that was happening within those communities as well, which I wouldn't have had any kind of knowledge of at the time. And Hannah, I know you're a bit of an expert on this subject.
Hannah, you're an AIDS geek.
I mean, 1984 was big year in AIDS, which is 1984 is the year that this starts, obviously, and then it moves on to 1991. It doesn't go into it in any great depth, but the spectre of it is there, and
the fact that they're considering it, that it's like on their minds that they've got to be careful and whatever, is
absolutely. But all of that said, Angela Bassett turns up and punches a fucking feminist hole in the middle of this film when she says to Furious, like, yeah, you brought your kid up, but like women do that all the time and no one gives them any credit for it. And so I did do a little cheer that I don't think Boys in the Hood, the film, is intrinsically sexist. I think it is set in a sexist society.
Yeah.
I like the way that she finishes that with, now drink the coffee I bought you.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, she's bettering herself, isn't she? She's doing her MA and you yeah. hear about that right from the start. And she is the one, you know, and she seems to sort of go up in the world, doesn't she, over the course of the film as well, because she looks like she's living somewhere quite nice. When she's chatting later.
Now, this is interesting. The restaurant she takes him to is fully occupied by white people.
I didn't even notice that.
So she's gone up in the world, so to speak. And is that what people are supposed to aim for? Because that, you know, seems like it's much, much harder to achieve in a way, as opposed to black people being successful, which is obviously what Furious is talking about. Like, look, we need to be the owners, which makes sense. And the other, I guess, complicated or additionally complicated character is the black cop, who is much more racist than his white counterpart.
Yeah.
Yeah, the internalised racism he's terrifying. Oh,
he's so scary.
Fucking awful. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting, and again, like, it's a bigger, way bigger conversation, but just as an FYI, while we're on race, John Singleton actually directed the episode of The People versus OJ. He directed the Race Card episode, which is the one that specifically focuses on OJ Simpson's attitude to race and Johnny Cochran's attitude to race. I tell you something else I just love about this film is that there's two callbacks to another just beautiful coming of age film, which is Stand By Me.
I noticed that they
find a dead body
and they're on the railway tracks
and go and look for it, and then at the end Ice Cube as Doughboy fades out of shot as he's walking away, which is what happens to Chris at the end of Stand By Me.
I meant to look it up and I didn't, so I assume Stand By Me is an earlier film.
About 1984, I think.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Oh, they're definitely nods from Singleton to this is a obviously another coming-of-age film that I really
fucking
like.
Love that film.
Yeah.
So good.
I mean, I don't know when the right time to say it, but I do want to say is, you know, I'm not an expert on race, but I am an expert on Catholic girls, and I can say we are indeed the biggest hoochies.
Okay, so, guys, I'm going to ask the question. I think I probably know the answer, but let us ask it anyway. Rated or dated? Mick, I'll start with you.
Rated. It's one of those films that even though it's absolutely undeniably rated, and I'm speaking for all of us here. No, I'm speaking for me, obviously. Did I enjoy it? I don't know. I think that's a slightly different question because it is so sad and bleak. But, yeah, absolutely cracking film. So good.
Hannah?
Yeah, what Mick said.
Yeah, I agree. I think what you said at the start is absolutely right. It's still so relevant, and that is kind of the awful thing, isn't it?
Heartbreaking.
Anyway, have we got anything more uplifting to watch next week?
Well, a little bit of Michael J. Fox, as we are going to watch a film that I remember utterly loving the few times I've seen it, but I have not seen it for ages, and that is The Frighteners.
Peter Jackson.
I don't think I've ever I don't even think I've ever heard of that.
Could go either way, Jen.
Standard Issue for All Women.